just a few showers, but also some sunny spells. But it will be quite blustery for Northern Ireland and Scotland. Highs of 12 or 13 degrees, but feeling a little cooler than that in the wind. And Sunday's weather, well, we'll see sunshine and showers for Northern Ireland and Scotland. Dry with sunny spells for England and Wales, and highs reaching 17 degrees. Back to Alan Smith.
Thank you, Sarah. This is BBC Radio 4. Now, Colin McFarlane reads a last extract from Thomas Brothers' new account of Louis Armstrong's early years in Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism.
By 1927, Armstrong's work at the Vendome and his hit song Heebie Jeebies made him a local celebrity. This was the song with which he was most associated until he recorded Ain't Misbehavin' in 1929. The record sales for Heebie Jeebies reached 40,000, and barely a month after it was released, OK Records were advertising it as the biggest selling record ever known. The success of it had little to do with composer Boyd Atkins' skill. Armstrong's Scat Chorus was the reason for its popularity. The huge impact of the recording caused many people to think that it documented the origins of scat, although this wasn't strictly the case. But associations with Armstrong remain strong to this day, especially as he would go on to incorporate the scat technique into his singing style in the future. Scat, a kind of wordless vocal improvisation, was received mainly as humor. Asked about heebie-jeebies, Lillian said, "I don't know if he planned to scat on that record or not. I know that Louis would always add little extra touches, little comical things to his work." Humor aside, scat had a solid place in African-American culture. It was a special example of blurring boundaries between speaking, singing, and playing an instrument, which gave rise in turn to a rich array of creative possibilities. From Joe Oliver's virtuoso freak music, African-American preaching styles, blues phrasing, and talking blues. "Well, my singing's nothing," said Armstrong in 1931. "I just try to put the rhythm of instrumental playing into my voice." It's as if he's strutting down the dirt streets of New Orleans in a crowded, funky parade, doing what he can to draw attention to himself. Percussive consonants explode from his gravelly throat, and his melodic utterances are so vivid, you can almost see them. It's significant that Armstrong did not introduce it at the Sunset or the Vendome. The place to do it turned out to be a recording studio, hiding behind a supposed mistake. OK Records was now encouraging their star to sing as well as play, so Atkins, too, needed some words, which Armstrong supplied himself. He wrote out some words on a bit of paper and brought them along to the studio. What happened next is another famous moment in jazz history. In the middle of the recording, he accidentally dropped the paper. Not wanting to spoil the wax cylinder in which they were recording, he kept going, continuing the performance with scat. This is not apocryphal, and has been confirmed by independent witnesses. He did drop a piece of paper, but was it on purpose? He was then surprised that OK went ahead and released the recording, but the studio turned out to be the best place to take this risk. The impersonal recording machine enabled innovation. After all, spoiled wax could be melted down and reused, so why not try something new? OK was handsomely rewarded, and the next day, Armstrong performed it in public at the Chicago Coliseum, which boosted the success of the record and lifted it into a more lucrative market, that is, into a white market. But the tune continued to be strongly associated with him among the black audience, too. Ultimately, scat would open up a new style for Armstrong, but that came slowly. His huge success with Heebie Jeebies put him on the map as a singer in the entertainment world, lifting him higher and higher. In early April of 1927, an offer came from none other than Joe Oliver, Armstrong's old mentor, who was now running a band at the Plantation Cafe. Armstrong said yes. He was on his way to rehearsal there when he bumped into Red Hot jazz pianist Earl Hines, who was also on his way to a rehearsal, though not with Oliver. He was employed by the Sunset across the street, and he decided to go to work on his friend. "Why don't you come on over and work with us young fellas instead?" Here is another special turning point moment in Armstrong's life story, when he made a choice between the greatest influence of his formative years and the musician Hines, who was best able to keep up with him in 20s Chicago.
I loved Joe Oliver, and here I was back in Chicago. I thought I'd be more at home with him sitting by his side, he remembered.
But Lil convinced him to go to the Sunset, and they sweetened the deal with $10 more per week than Oliver could offer. Both the Plantation and the Sunset catered heavily to whites, so the success of both Oliver and Armstrong at these venues is an important measure of the growing reach of African-American jazz. The irony must have been evident to both the King and his successful student. Their dark skin and the African-American sounds of the Deep South had been a liability at these locations just a few years earlier. Now, both markers were assets.
All the white people, the rich people from Sheridan Road and the big hotels, would come out there on the South Side, Armstrong remembered.
The term coined for this social phenomenon was slumming. The white draw depended on their sense of safety, and the reputation of organized crime helped make the area feel safe, ironically enough. Both clubs were thickly bound up with organized crime, if not run by it totally. The Sunset may have provided Armstrong's first sustained exposure to gangsters, a world he would remain connected to for years to come. This was the era of prohibition, of course, and alcohol, the lifeblood of the crime scene, was a big part of cabaret entertainment. A New Year's Eve raid on both cabarets that year exposed a scene of some 500 merrymaking men and women, both white and colored, drinking heavily and dancing wildly. A quick investigation uncovered an alcohol storage depot 2 doors down from the Plantation Cafe. Kingpin Al Capone enlisted local blacks into his operation and had a reputation for treating them fairly. He was described as a Robin Hood figure by some and admired by the locals. He'd sit down and talk to them and say,
"I'm the boss, but you're gonna make money long as you buy your alcohol from me, huh?"
Police were paid off, and little intrusions like the New Year's raid were cleared up quickly. Armstrong described Al Capone as
a nice little cute fat boy, young, like some professor who just come out of college to teach or something.
He developed a special relationship with Capone, which is startling, but not all that surprising given the dynamics of the situation. Capone was very fond of music. In one story, he requested a particular dance number from clarinetist Johnny Dodds, but he didn't know the tune. Capone took out a $100 bill, tore it in half, put one half in his pocket, and poked the other half in Dodds' pocket, saying,
"Dodds, you better learn it for next time."
Upscale cabarets tried to create an elite atmosphere, and the Sunset and the Plantation were aiming for the top. Customers wanted to appear rich and glamorous, and the steep prices helped them to do that. Even though an integrated experience was an attraction at these two venues, their success was based on the patronage of high-rolling whites. Fundamentally, they were places of white privilege. Why did they come? It was certainly more than a thirst for peppy entertainment and bootleg booze. For some, it may have been to bolster their sense of a social, racial hierarchy. Here they could confirm assumptions that African-derived cultures were lacking in qualities that made white society so obviously advanced. They were deficient in reason, critical capacity, and control over their emotions, hence their lack of progress, culturally, socially, politically, and intellectually. But these alleged differences also included a mysterious set of advantages. The primitives had access to creativity. They were spontaneous and intuitive, unrepressed, and sexy. Some white clientele may have considered that their race had lost something as they'd evolved to a higher plane. Perhaps an ability to be released from the burdens of civilization. On the South Side of Chicago, they could go to these clubs and return, temporarily, to primal freshness. Thus formed a taut and heady mixture of condescension and desire. Quite an emotional mix. There was perhaps no other space so perfect as this one, with its combination of white hegemony and the skillful channeling of black primitivism into cultural forms like the Charleston, Cafe Au Lait dancing girls, and Louis Armstrong's stunning solos. Blacks were understood to be more in touch with their libidos than whites were. Thus, sex was a huge part of the pleasure at the clubs, with black dance and music defining in a very public way what sexual liberation was all about. The thrill for slumming whites of hooking up with black men and women was also one of the reasons that the clubs retained integrated policies, and one of the reasons the moralists were so outraged. "Slumming parties are apparently finding delight in seeing the intermingling of the races," complained the Juvenile Protective Association. A tradition in the clubs of flirting via notes delivered by waiters was called passing grenades because of the occasional blow-ups the practice generated. Prostitutes solicited by winking from the tables. White musicians had another incentive to come along. They wanted to get the black players on side, get them to show them their jazz tricks. One black journalist warned, "Hold on to your ideas. Don't show them a thing," inferring that anyone who violated this principle was an Uncle Tom. But his words had no impact. There was too much momentum in the other direction. The list of white musicians to patronize the Sunset is long. Bix Beiderbecke, Benny Goodman, Jimmy and Tommy Dorsey, Joe Sullivan, Bing Crosby. That's just a start. They frequently sat in with the band, giving the black musicians a break. This was considered a natural thing to do, part of the mix of condescension and admiration. Earl Hines recalls the need to be deferential to them.
"Whatever section they wanted to sit in, why a musician would step out from his chair."
Armstrong was flattered by this attention.
"Well, I was up from the South. I was just thrilled with the closeness and warmth of these great musicians and performers," he wrote 30 years later. "It gave me such a lift. And there ain't one of them alive that don't play a little something I used to play. Makes them feel like they're getting hot or something. Real Negroid. And that's all right. Makes me feel good."
The 20s were a time of transition in white attitudes to black entertainment. There was a vision, however distorted, of a shared humanity that made black culture not only fun, but therapeutic. The case can be made that this hung around right up through the advent of rock and roll, and is still evident today. Armstrong was a catalyst and a witness to the expansion of this phenomenon. As his career developed steadily from there, moving Armstrong into an increasingly populist and mainstream entertainment world, from the big bands of the 30s to Hollywood musicals and beyond, there's been much discussion about whether or not his step into the white market was a sellout of tragic proportions and a surrender to the creepy tentacles of commercialism. Some insist that Armstrong made his greatest recordings, the Hot Fives and Sevens, in the mid-20s, after which came creative deterioration. This notion is played out in writings about jazz history for many decades, but today, it's easy to see that his turn to the mainstream was no tragedy at all, but rather, a step that presented a new set of limitations and possibilities, to which he responded beautifully. The whole point of making music for him was a dynamic dialogue between his radical, ragging invention and the popular tune. One reason Louis Armstrong was so important is the extremely high quality of his music. Another is the complexity of the social environments in which his music was performed. His experiences reveal much about how African-American music functioned and evolved in the first half of the 20th century. Put the two together, the greatness of the music and the social context, and he becomes the ultimate representative of African-American musical history.
"No one talking all by myself. No one walking. I might be on a show, babe. Ain't misbehaving. Saving my love. Oh, babe, love you. Really, babe, love you. I know it's saying one I love. Through it floating. You that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving."
Colin McFarlane was reading from Master of Modernism by Thomas Brothers. The book is abridged by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and it's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency. A 0015 today, Saturday the 12th of April. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Developing low, moving northeast, expected 100 miles northeast of Faroes, 970 by 1800 Saturday. High 300 miles west of Fitzroy, 1028. Slow moving with little change. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira. Southwesterly, veering westerly 5 to 7. Occasionally gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later in Viking. Rain then squally showers. Moderate or good, occasionally poor. South Utsira. Southwesterly, veering westerly 4 or 5.